Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are continuing our exploration of the REFT program.
We are, and we're getting into what is really the pivotal third stage.
Specifically, we're on Chapter 34, which is just simply titled Freedom.
And just as a quick reminder for everyone, REFT is an acronym. It stands for R, Recognize, A, Abandon, F, Freedom, and T, Train.
We pronounce it just like the word raft.
Exactly. So we've spent time on recognize and abandon, which are stages of real effort. You're charting the territory, dropping habits.
A lot of doing.
A lot of doing. Now with freedom, the mission changes. We're moving away from that effort of doing and more toward, I'd say, the gentle art of being.
Okay, so that's our mission for this deep dive, to understand how we can actively pivot from that constant struggle to a sense of liberation. And to see that the peace is maybe already there.
It is. It's already accessible.
I really love the way the REFT program sets this up with its opening quotes. There's one from Veronica A. Schofstall about a silence inside us as vast as the universe.
And that's paired with Stephen Batchelor, who gives us the really practical working definition we'll be using.
Which is?
That freedom is the absence of the compulsion to grasp or resist.
That just changes everything, doesn't it?
It really does. It means it's not something you have to go out and acquire. It's the space that just opens up when the usual wanting and pushing stops.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We've gone through recognize. We've started to abandon.
Right.
Why is freedom a whole stage in itself and not just, you know, the result at the end?
That is such a crucial question. It's foundational because it's anchored in this this radical certainty of Gautama, the Buddha.
His third realization.
Exactly. That an end to all this unnecessary distress and these compulsive patterns, it's actually possible.
So it's not just a nice philosophical idea?
Not at all. It's presented as an attainable reality.
Right.
And the REFT program is very clear. You have to personally experience this. You have to verify for yourself that it's possible.
Because if you don't really believe it, deep down.
Then you can't fully dedicate yourself to the journey, can you? You'll always hold back.
So if the first stages were about effort and sort of identifying the problems, this third stage is a total reorientation of our attention.
A complete reorientation. We stop trying to fix the mind. We stop fighting the waves.
And we start looking for the clear spots instead.
Yes. You're training your attention, which the program calls the captain of your vessel, to notice, to appreciate, and to intentionally dwell in those moments when craving and compulsion are just absent.
Looking for the stillness, not the storm.
That's the whole practice.
But I imagine for a lot of us, that absence is actually really hard to spot. I mean, we're so wired to focus on the drama, the problems.
We are.
So how does this freedom even show up? Is it a big event?
It's usually the opposite. It's often so anticlimactic that we just miss it entirely. It appears as a stopping. Yeah, like a subtle hush. The internal chatter about wanting this or pushing that away just goes quiet for a second. Stephen Batchelor calls it seeing the stopping of reactivity.
Right, that usual chain of events.
Yeah.
A trigger, then an emotional charge.
Yeah.
Then the same old reaction.
Yes. The automatic snap of judgment or the impulse to just dive in.
So freedom is the gap.
It's that momentary clean interval, that single breath where nothing has to be added or pushed away. We call it the still point or the hinge.
The hinge, I like that.
It's the pivot point. It's where you can shift from that automatic reaction to a chosen response. That tiny pause is the doorway.
The hinge analogy really makes it concrete, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's not about finding some huge new ocean of peace. It's about widening a single split second gap.
That's all it is.
And if we connect this back to the RAFT metaphor, we spent the first two stages making our vessel seaworthy.
And now we're unfurling the sail.
Catching the natural current.
Exactly. We're learning to stop relying only on, you know, the sheer muscle of paddling and start using the natural winds of ease and liberation that are already blowing.
But here's the key part, I think.
Yeah.
The program says we have to stop dismissing those moments of calm as boring.
Oh, that is so critical. If you're sitting quietly and you're not actively struggling with something, your mind might say, this is boring. What's next?
Right. I should be doing something.
But that's not boring. That is a glimpse of the safe shore. Those are the moments you have to recognize and value. Otherwise, the sail just stays furled.
That's the real challenge. Valuing subtle ease over heroic struggle. So if we are sailing, we know the weather can change in an instant. Does the RAFT program give us a map for this?
It does, a very detailed one. Because freedom isn't a permanent achievement, it's a dynamic balance. The clear sky of the mind is always subject to weather.
So we need to navigate the forces at play.
Yes, and there are two distinct kinds. The program calls them the five hazards, those are the storms, and the seven supports, which are the skills you cultivate to counter them.
Okay, let's talk about the storms first. The five hazards. I'm guessing these are the core triggers that pull us back into old patterns.
That's exactly what they are. They cloud the mind. First, you have sensual desire, the pull towards pleasure or just distraction.
Number one on the list.
Always. Second, ill will, so anger, resentment, just pushing things away. Third is tuning out.
What does that mean exactly?
It's that mental dullness, sleepiness, a kind of sluggishness where you're just not present.
Got it. Then the fourth.
Anxiety and agitation, restlessness, worry. And finally, number five is immobilizing doubt.
Doubting the process or yourself.
Right. That thought of this will never work for me, those five cover most of it.
They certainly do. So to counter these storms, we have the seven supports. These are the active skills.
These are the antidotes we cultivate. They are liberating mindfulness, penetrating inquiry, enthusiasm, energizing joy, deep calm, a unified mind, and balance.
And the beauty of this is that the practice becomes really targeted. You're not just, meditating vaguely.
Not at all. You're applying a specific antidote to a specific hazard. It's very precise.
Okay, give us an example. How does that balancing act work in a real moment of struggle?
Okay, let's take the hazard of tuning out. You notice that mental fog rolling in. You feel dull, heavy, maybe your eyes are drooping.
Happens to me every afternoon around 3.
Right. So you wouldn't apply deep calm there, would you? That would just make you fall asleep.
No, that would be counterproductive.
Instead, you inject energy. You bring in enthusiasm and penetrating inquiry. You wake the mind up by asking, what is this exactly? How does this dullness feel in my body right now? Inquiry cuts right through the fog.
That makes perfect sense. You bring light to the darkness. And the opposite would be true for, say, anxiety and agitation.
Exactly. When the raft is rocking violently with worry or restlessness, you don't want more energy. That would be a disaster.
You need to stabilize things.
You stabilize it. You apply deep calm and the grounding presence of liberating mindfulness. Mindfulness brings you right back to the feeling of your feet on the floor, the breath in your body. It anchors you.
And what about that last one, balance?
Balance is the master skill. It's the wisdom of knowing which support to apply when. It's knowing whether you need to inject energy or apply calm.
So we're really learning to be our own internal climate control system. This makes the goal so much more practical. It's not some abstract piece, it's a present tense skill.
And the methods for practicing it are very concrete. The first step is just to notice the stopping.
Like a motor humming and then going quiet.
Yes. You feel that subtle relief when the compulsion to grasp or resist just subsides. It might be a tiny softening in your jaw or your shoulders.
But the immediate trap there, I think, is that as soon as you notice the calm, you think, oh,
This is it.
I have to hold on to this.
And you've just lost it.
Right.
That's why the very next step is crucial. Rest in non-reactivity. The moment you grasp at the calm, it's not freedom anymore. It's just another object of craving.
So you're just familiarizing yourself with the feeling, not trying to achieve or possess it.
Familiarizing. That is the perfect word for it.
I do want to push back on this idea of resting in non-reactivity for a second. How is that different from tuning out, which you just said was a hazard? They sound similar.
That is a vital, vital distinction. Tuning out is dull. It's foggy, confused. You're basically asleep at the wheel.
You've checked out.
You've checked out. Resting in non-reactivity is the opposite. It's bright, it's clear, it's alert. The mental churning has stopped, but you are fully present. You're resting in presence, not checking out of it.
That clarity is the key. And the RFT program talks about using if-then plans to help maintain this state, right?
Yes, these are brilliant. They are pre-decisions you make to replace a reflex with a choice. So, for example, if I feel that familiar knot of anxiety in my stomach, then I will take five slow breaths and name the sensation.
You have a plan before the storm even hits.
So the deep calm has a chance to anchor you before the agitation can take over.
And as this non-reactivity becomes more familiar, the program says something beautiful happens. It talks about the everyday sublime.
It does. It sounds a bit grand, but all it means is that as the filters of craving and aversion get quieter, your direct perception gets sharper.
The world becomes more vivid.
Exactly. Colors are a little brighter, sounds are clearer. The taste of your morning coffee is actually there, without all the mental commentary. It's the simple joy of being present.
I'm thinking of that Bachelor quote again, where he says, "The sublime is not reducible to magnificent sunsets. If you look carefully at the tiniest detail, that is just as awe-inspiring as the stars."
That's it, the sheer complexity of a single leaf. And this clarity naturally expresses itself ethically. Living in a harmless way becomes the obvious choice when you're not constantly reacting from a place of fear or greed.
So let's ground this in science. This all sounds like ancient wisdom, which it is, but how does contemporary science look at this? Is this freedom thing just philosophical, or is it physically real?
Oh, it's entirely embodied. Neuroscience confirms it through neuroplasticity. Every time you consciously pause and choose not to react, you are literally rewiring your brain.
You're strengthening the prefrontal cortex, the PFC.
You are. The PFC is your brain's CEO. It handles emotional regulation, planning, and this is the key, it inhibits those impulsive habitual responses.
So each time we use that hinge, we're doing a rep at the mental gym.
A perfect analogy. And at the same time, you're reducing the over-responsiveness of the amygdala, the brain's little alarm system. But maybe the most important part is how this quiets the default mode network, the DMN.
Which is the brain storyteller.
Yeah.
The Me My Problems channel that's always on.
Precisely. The DMN is what's active when you're ruminating, worrying, caught up in your story. Quieting the DMN moves your mind out of that narrative of suffering and into direct, non-judgmental experience. Ease actually becomes structurally safer in your brain.
That is profound. And this maps so well onto modern psychology, too.
It aligns perfectly with approaches like acceptance and commitment therapy or ACT.
Right, where the core idea is that fighting your discomfort just makes it stronger.
Exactly. ACT calls freedom psychological flexibility. It's the ability to allow all of your experienced thoughts, feelings, sensations to be there without getting consumed by them so that you can choose an action that aligns with your values.
So freedom isn't the absence of pain. It's the absence of the compulsion to immediately get rid of the pain using your old harmful strategies.
That is the whole distinction. It's responding from a place of clarity and space, not from a place of tightness and fear.
And philosophically, this brings us right back to the start.
It does. It's the Stoic ideal of ataraxia, freedom from disturbance. Bachelor's hinge is the perfect image. Awareness is the steady axis that experience turns on, but the center itself doesn't move.
The mind just clears when we stop compulsively grasping, pushing, and spinning stories.
We finally see things as they are.
And that assurance that this freedom is not only possible but accessible right here, right now, that's the core message of this stage. It's telling you that suffering intensified by compulsion is not your final destiny.
It is not. Freedom is revealed every single time grasping relaxes, even for a moment.
And for all of you who want to explore this more deeply, the entire RAFT to Freedom workbook, which is the resource for this deep dive, is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And they are progressively releasing all 67 chapters for free online.
You can find everything. The deep explanations, the exercises, the self-reflection prompts at raft2freedom.org. That's raft, the number two, freedom.org.
It's an incredible resource.
Before we wrap up, we want to leave you with one of those prompts from the program for your own reflection.
It's a great one.
What obstacles arise when you try to notice or appreciate moments of peace? For example, restlessness, disbelief, or maybe that feeling of waiting for something bigger to happen.
A question to sit with, because as the teacher Jack Kornfield says, when we let go of the struggle, what remains is the tenderness of life itself.
A perfect place to end this deep dive.